The Vietnam War, regarded by some as the Cold War proxy war between communist nations and anti-communist nations, lasted from November 1, 1955 to April 30, 1975. While the United States was present in the region beginning as early as 1950, full-scale combat involving U.S. troops began full tilt on March 8, 1965, marking the beginning of the American ground war in Vietnam. For 7 years, Robert McNamara served as Secretary of Defense under both Presidents John F. Kennedy and Lyndon B. Johnson. Thereafter, he became the president of the World Bank in 1968. One could extrapolate that the Vietnam War was a war between communism and capitalism. Until quite recently, the Vietnam War was regarded by many as America's darkest hour. Indeed, the Vietnam War inspired a very powerful wave of protest from counterculturalists across America and beyond. For Voices of Counterculture, this is Jack Leffler. David Perkins has lived much of his long life at the Libre Commune in the Huerfano Valley of southern Colorado. He is one of tens of thousands of American men who faced conscription into military service during the Vietnam War.
The biggest of all was Vietnam. People would drop out of school like a year early. This one friend of mine said, "I'm going to go down and finish village and play with the thugs, you know." And I said, "We got one more year. If you drop out, you're eligible to be drafted." "No, they won't draft me. They won't want me." He drops out, goes down to Greenwich Village and hangs around. And they draft his ass, send him to Vietnam, and he gets killed. Boom. So it was very, very tough. There's a reason to stay in graduate school, for one thing. You know, I spent, 2 years at least, maneuvering through the bureaucracy of staying out of the war. Some might call it a draft dodger. I certainly don't view it that way. There was no way I was going to be party to that atrocity. I had to dress up like Charlie Manson and go to my draft physical and be an insane person. And I'm sure the psychiatrist just thought, "Okay, you're a Yale graduate and you're insane, right?" And I went, "Yep, definitely insane." So I just stuck with it and, you know, eventually got a psychological deferment and shuffled off into graduate school. But a lot of my friends didn't go that route. They said, "I can't dodge the draft because my father's going to be Secretary of the Treasury or my father's going to be the Surgeon General. And I've got to uphold this tradition. I can't do this to my family." And so they got sent off and have never been the same, you know, or died or else came back kind of mentally a mess that they never entirely recovered from. All the stuff in the streets, they virtually burned down the university the year I was up there and burned the ROTC building down and had to cancel classes. And I don't think there's been anything like it since then in terms of that level of public protest, I suppose you'd say. We were kind of carried out of that on a wave of not wanting to do that anymore and to move to the West where we could run free.
Roberta Price was also a communard at Libre Commune during part of the Vietnam War. Here, she shares her perspective.
At the time, you know, we were a generation brought up, according to Dr. Spock, and the news reporting of war was completely different than it is today. There was just much more freedom, so we were actually seeing on television the horrible reality of war. And plus the newspaper men at that time were not entirely supportive of the war and were independent in a way. We were seeing it on our TV. We were personally impacted because the men our age were having to face with where they're going to go die for this country. You know, our parents' generation had been through World War II, the Honorable War, the Good War. So they naturally assumed that the Vietnam War was a continuation of that. We, on the other hand, who had to go die, the men we were involved with, our friends, had to go die or decide what they were going to do. It was just, you know, I think one of the most skillful things they did was eliminate the draft.
John Brandy is a poet and artist who has lived in New Mexico for decades. He presents his perspective as one who was confronted with being drafted into U.S. military service during the Vietnam War.
The war in Vietnam was increasing I decided there were so many people standing up against the war that the wisest and most truthful thing I could do was to say no in the courts. And I talked to lawyers about it, and they said, you're probably going to be on a waiting list for 2 years before they ever get to your case. You probably won't go to jail, but you're going to have this on your record. And I said, I don't care. I was empowered during that era because it wasn't me going to be standing up alone saying no. Everywhere I looked, there were people saying no, everywhere. That focus against that war and stopping that war was tremendous.
My friend Enrique Lamadrid is a native New Mexican who graduated from the University of New Mexico in 1970. He tells of what he did to avoid being drafted and shipped off to Vietnam, perchance to die in combat.
It didn't help that I got a number 10 on the draft lottery, and all my well-laid plans just went out the window, just crumbling, just literally crisis mode, you know, like, what am I going to do? Go to Canada? Go to jail? I graduated in 1970 from UNM, and so this all hits, and after exploring all possible avenues, that's how I ended up on the Navajo Reservation, doing alternative service, which was never even approved, but I did it anyway, and I found other ways to get around the tiger without stepping on its tail. Well, I did step on its tail, but it didn't bite me. This was all very poignant because my life was on the line. I was not about to go to Vietnam. It was like this daily struggle.
Robert D'Alessandro is a photographer who selects to follow his own trail through life. He lives in Placitas, New Mexico, a community of mavericks.
They just came through Vietnam, and see, with Vietnam, they missed it because the media still was in the hands of people like Cronkite, and they were putting on the bombing of the villages. And you could see as a young person that this was bullshit, that this was lying, murder. This was terrorism, if you want to call it for what it was. It was terrorism. You go in with jet planes and blow up a whole village because there were some black pajamas there? What the hell are you doing? That's terrorism. Now they built this whole thing about terrorism with the Iraq War. It's all controlled. They knew they had to control the media. Back then, the media just put it on and didn't realize it, what it was teaching. But the media always teaches. Art teaches. Art always teaches. And they were putting it on, and then they got the reaction they did from people like, from my generation, because we could see it for what it was. And then with Dylan and the music and all of that stuff, it was crystal clear. You know, when Jimi Hendrix played the Star Spangled Banner at Woodstock, you know, that was the truth. That was the truth. How much more do you need to know? What, was this some John Wayne movie? Bullshit. This was murder. This was imperialism. This was ridiculous. It was unnecessary. I liked Lyndon Johnson, but I hated that he goofed up with the war.
Lisa Law lived in both the Haight-Ashbury in San Francisco and the village of Truchas in New Mexico during the years of the Vietnam War. She tells of her experience in Haight-Ashbury and of protesting the war.
During that same time that we were doing the human being and all that, there was a march against the war in Vietnam that happened in San Francisco. I know it was 60,000 people marched against the war and then went to the Kezar Stadium where Coretta Scott King spoke. It was the biggest march at that point. That march was incredible because we knew that it was a war that should never have happened. So Robert McNamara had actually created the war against Vietnam, and which he admits later in the movie The Fog of War. It didn't have to happen. And all these young men were going over there, and women, and being killed, and killing people that they shouldn't be killing. And we wanted them to get out of Vietnam. And when they came back, we were accused of spitting on them for being in the war. But as far as my recollection, we wanted them out of the war to protect them because we didn't feel they should be dying. There was nothing to die for. And so there was this conflict between what they thought, we thought, and what was really happening. And when they came back, they had no place to go. So in Golden Gate Park, later for years, that's where the Vietnam vets would end up living. And when I did my film, Flashing on the 60s, there were 500 veterans living in Golden Gate Park under the bushes. And Food Not Bombs was feeding them.
My friend Michael Naranjo was born into the Tewa Pueblo of Santa Clara, situated on the western banks of the Rio Grande in northern New Mexico. Michael served in the United States Army in Vietnam and engaged the Viet Cong in combat. He was critically wounded and thus lost both his eyesight and the use of his right hand. In spite of this, he is now an internationally recognized sculptor who relies on his refined sense of touch and his extraordinary imagination to create sculptures that profoundly reveal his Pueblo Indian cultural perspective. Michael Naranjo tells of getting wounded in combat in Vietnam.
I saw this man really looking around, straight ahead, out in the jungle, looking for something else to shoot up. Now the gunships were coming in too, these miniguns, machine guns, and they shot rockets into the jungle. Yazir and I would duck my squad sergeant when they came over us because we were right there. And so this first Viet Cong in the first foxhole, I saw him and I pointed my rifle at him, and just at that moment he turned and looked towards me, and as he looked at me, our eyes met for a second, we looked at each other and I shot. And Yazir said something, I don't know what he said, but I ducked because I was expecting more automatic weapons fired from somewhere. And so I was in this mud depression, and I didn't want to bring my rifle down, so I held it up on the edge of the mud depression. It was only about a couple feet deep. So I rolled over on my right side to pull out my last hand grenade out of my leg pocket and lob it in front of me right there where they're at. And so I have my grenade in this hand, and I let go of my rifle right up on the edge. I thought I'd be okay there. And I was going to switch hands and pull the pin with my left hand and lob the grenade with my right hand. But the minute I let go of my rifle, I felt the sort of ball roll into my hand. It gently rolled into my hand, and I knew immediately what it was. And I started to turn towards it. And I never saw it. It just gently rolled away from my hand. And just as I was getting ready, probably getting close to seeing it, it exploded. And it was a big blast. And I felt myself like I was suspended. There was this hum and this silence. And it felt like I was on my knees. And I knew I was going to die. And I said, "Dear God, don't make it too hard on my parents." And then I waited to die. And I saw this little red dot with this little red string, red line going round and round this little red dot. And all of a sudden I hear Yazir say, "Baby, are you okay?" I said, "Just get me out of here." And for some reason they didn't shoot me. I guess they thought I was probably going to waste a shot. And I tried to stand up. I stood up, and I fell backwards. And Yazir grabbed me by the collar and dragged me back behind that dike he threw the grenade from. And I asked him how bad it was. I couldn't see anymore. He said, "You're going to be okay." I knew it was bad. He said, "You're going to be okay, baby." He said, "Do you have another grenade?" I said, "I left one in the mud hole." And now my tongue was getting really full and heavy. I guess I was losing a lot of blood, and I was so thirsty. Never been so thirsty in my life, and it felt like my tongue filled the hole of my mouth. And I heard him shoot, and I thought, "Oh my God, if they got him, then no one's going to know where I'm at, and I'm going to die." So he came back, and he cut my pants and gave me a shot, a morphine shot, I guess, these little morphine shots we have with us. And I asked him again, "Am I going to be okay?" And he said, "You're going to be okay." And by then, other men in the open rice field started coming the same way we had come in. Somehow, I guess, since we had gotten right in on them and shooting down their lane of foxholes. They probably got out of their foxholes because now they're targets. So they went back into the jungle so everyone else got out of the rice field. So here came the priest, and he gave me my last rites. And then four men put me on a poncho, and they went racing through the jungle back to where the helicopters had landed. Once I was falling off, they stopped. Not with any care at all, they threw me back on the poncho and grabbed the four corners and went racing through the jungle again to where the choppers had dropped us off. Someone had called in a medevac. And so we got to the edge, and there were two gunships in front of the medevac coming down. And they were shooting at the gunships now, the Viet Cong, from that side as well. I guess they were all along up there. We had just come in on them and unexpectedly. And so the medevac was coming in real low, right behind the gunships. And they said, here it comes, get ready. And they grabbed the corners and went racing out into the rice field to throw me into the chopper. But they suddenly spun around, went racing back into the jungle and threw me into the jungle because the chopper was getting shot at too much. And the gunships made a big swing with the medevac, and they came around and they said, here it comes again, get ready. And they got ready and they grabbed the poncho and racing out. And the chopper barely didn't even land. It just probably hovered for a split second. They flung me up into it through the open doors and they went running off, and choppers took off. And I kept talking to anybody and everybody. And the guys dragging me to the jungle, because everything was getting so heavy and dark. And I thought, as long as I'm talking, I know I'm alive. And so the corpsman and the medic in the chopper stripped all my clothes off, just cut it off, and I was late, put me on a stretcher, put a splint on my right arm and gave me a shot, and I was trying to talk to the pilots and him, asking the kids where they're from, anything, just so I could talk, because it was so dark and so heavy. And then all of a sudden, we landed, and the stretcher I was on got jerked out of the chopper, and I guess it got put on a gurney, and they went racing across the helipad and in through these doors, and there are these doctors and nurses, and they were trying to get my service number and my name, and I was telling them, and then some doctor said, I'm going to give you a shot in the shoulder here. You're going to go out in a few seconds. And a day or so later, I woke up, and first voice I heard was a Vietnamese voice, and I thought, oh my God, where am I? And then I heard some other American voices, and I thought, oh, I'm in a hospital somewhere. And so I went in and out for a while until finally I came around long enough, and the doctor came and told me what all had been done. And so I was there for about a week, and there was a little Vietnamese girl who would feed me. And because both her arms were tied down, I couldn't get out of bed. And she couldn't speak English. And she played this little game with me. I couldn't see. My face was all bandaged and hands were tied down. And she'd blow air on my face, on my left side. And I'd turn my head that way. And then suddenly she would blow air on my face on my right side. And then she'd giggle and then she'd go off to go do her work. But then she'd come around and play that game every once in a while. And she, when she was ready to put something in my mouth, she'd say, up-m. I opened my mouth and she would feed me. So I was there for a couple of weeks. Then I went to this 24th evacuation. That was the 24th evacuation hospital. And from there, I went to this other place for a couple of days. I don't know where that was. And then from there, I went to Japan.
Resistance to mainstream culture took many forms during the 1960s and 1970s. What was to become the Chicano movement was comprised of different elements. In New Mexico, a small group of Hispano intellectuals, writers, artists, and musicians created La Academia de la Nueva Raza that became a powerful force in redefining Chicano culture. One of the foremost proponents was poet E. A. Tony Mares, a man of profound intelligence and insight whom I was honored to regard as my friend.
In the early 70s, around 1972-1973, I became involved with La Academia de la Nueva Raza, or the Academy of the New People, as we called it. It was Academia was a social and political activist organization that was founded on the idea of community, the idea that one's community, one's language, one's culture were important, and that building a social consciousness on the basis of your deep understanding of your own language, your own culture, your own community, prepared you to be a better citizen and a better participant in any democratic process. And it certainly prepared you, or could at least theoretically prepare you, to defend your rights and to protect yourself and your community from outside exploitation.
A foremost founder of La Academia de la Nueva Raza was Tomás Atencio, who hailed from Dixon, New Mexico, and was highly regarded for both his activism and his academic career. He addresses the nature of Hispano culture and mentions sinvergüenza, the shamelessness of those who choose to abandon their dignity and honor for personal gain.
There are many myths about working with Hispanic people. You know, yes, we have a communal nature. You know, we are communal. But it doesn't mean that you can get Chicano people to work together. The communal nature was based on a sense of reciprocity and sharing. But whenever you have this vergüenza business, this sinvergüenza coming out and going beyond, it breaks it all apart. There's no longer that same brotherhood. And today, most everybody is a sinvergüenza. Everybody will go, hey, you know, nobody trusts each other, see. So to come in there, the difference between the Chicanos and the Anglos, here's a good example, is that the Anglos can form alliances, and they do very well. You can be on the board of directors of a bank and do very, very well with somebody you don't like, personally. But you can't get Chicanos to work that way, because they don't see alliances as utilitarian things, you know. It either has to be an absolute trust in the group and decision by consensus, otherwise it doesn't work. See? So to get a village to work together on that, it won't, and it's hard. There's something else also that goes on with the Chicanos. Chicanos are very anarchistic, so to speak. You know, we have that, not the anarchism in the political sense of what went on in the 20s in this country, but a rural anarchism that came from Spain. E.A. Mares is the best proponent of this, Tony, of this idea, you know. And our group, Academia, is really made of anarchists, you know, yet how can we call ourselves a brotherhood, you know? And when you have this kind of worldview, it is very hard to trust the middleman. I mean, I don't say that the middleman ought to be trusted, you know, but you have to have a middleman. And so what happens is the middleman would sort of be a sinvergüenza. He would be the man, you know, or the woman who would say, okay, I will sell your products. If a Chicano comes and says that to other Chicanos, they're going to say, you say, you mean you're not going to do anything, but you're going to sell our products? So it won't happen. How does it happen with Anglos? The reason why Anglos can do it is because Anglos already have a cash flow. They come in and they say, okay, I'll buy you this, you know, right off the bat, you know.
As you know, Jack, I don't attach a label to anything I believe or think, but in terms of philosophical influences, anarchism has to be right, not near the top, but at the top of influences in my own thinking. It's the only social philosophy that has ever made any kind of sense to me. The idea that, you know, we as human beings are, yes, we are individuals, and we are born and we live in communities and we may travel all over the world, but we carry our culture with us, or we may, our culture may change, we interact with others, we learn other languages, we intermarry, and all this is wonderful, but we always retain, I think, an element of sovereignty over our individual selves. And I have always had difficulty understanding the need that apparently many people have to make icons out of other human beings, to consider a person somehow to be special because he's a president or a senator or a king. That has never made any sense to me at all. And in that sense, I share very much the anarchist tradition. And I've always admired people like Peter Kropotkin and Bakunin and other anarchist thinkers such as Emma Goldman, for example. I've read her autobiography cover to cover, and I highly recommend it as just plain good reading for anyone. It reads like an adventure story.
Mi gran compañero Enrique Lamadrid is one of the great folklorists and Hispano scholars of our time. Here, he gives his interpretation of querencia.
Querencia is a folk concept. It's a sense of belonging. It's a sense of rootedness. Querencia is the place where you know you belong. Sometimes it's the place where you're born. It's mobile. You can develop a new querencia in a new place. But how do you set down roots in a new place? There's many ways of doing that, of becoming part of a new place. And people certainly did it here. There's different senses of space, different senses of time in New Mexico. Spatially, since we arrived from the south, it's a north-south corridor. It is the Camino Real. We are norteños. Our being, our way of looking at things is always in reference to the south, where we came from. We're a southern people that came to a northern place, but our way of life has taken root here. The indigenous point of view in New Mexico is very different. Native peoples here have a sense of the center space. They've been here for so much longer as a culture of habitat that they are literally in the center of their world. People live in the center of a sacred space. This whole notion crosses the cultural boundary into the Hispano culture, which then becomes a kind of Indo-Hispano culture. And you get the Norteño orientation, but you also get a sense of centeredness that people learn after four centuries of being here. There's an extraordinary sense of cultural homeland. We call it querencia. People who are from New Mexico want to be in New Mexico. If they're not here, they're trying to figure out how to come home. Querencia means all of those things. It comes from the verb querer, to want or to love. It's a place that you love. It's a place that you want to be. It even has a sense of the place that you prefer to die in.
Cuento de las tierras, las donaciones de quienes fueron. Se ve triste el hombre de la sierra, pues destrozaron la naturaleza, le quitaron el agua y su tierra. Pues destrozaron la naturaleza, le quitaron el agua y su tierra.
Today we have heard the voices of David Perkins, Roberta Price, John Brandy, Robert D'Alessandro, Lisa Law, Michael Naranjo, Tony Mares, Tomas Atencio, and Enrique Lamadrid. We're hearing Cipriano Vigil perform his timeless Nueva Canción, Se Ve Triste el Hombre. Our theme was performed on the guitar by Carl Bernstein. Voices of Counterculture is funded by grants from the Museum of New Mexico Foundation and the Christensen Fund in San Francisco. Our radio series coincides with Voices of Counterculture in the Southwest, a major exhibition on display at the New Mexico History Museum at the Palace of the Governors in Santa Fe, extending from May 14, 2017 through February 11, 2018. The exhibition is accompanied by a book of the same title, Voices of Counterculture in the Southwest, published by the Museum of New Mexico Press. For Voices of Counterculture, this is Jack Leffler. Thank you for listening.
Nos quitaron el agua y la tierra.